My guest this week is Gay Morris, who lives in North Carolina and was previously based in the UK. That's how I first got to meet Gay. We collaborated about 15 years ago on a book called Theology and Film. And we talk about our rationale in writing it, the relationship between the Christian and the secular world. It was a validation of working on popular culture. And there's a fascinating moment when Gay talks about how she once got to talk with Linda Hamilton on a plane about a chapter on the Terminator that appeared in a previous Theology and Film book that Gay edited. Now, Gay taught public speaking and media and communication studies and a few religion and film classes at Augusta State University. She now teaches public speaking online, very appropriate during lockdown, to undergraduates. We learn that Gay's father was in the military, and as a family, they tended to move around. She remembers fooling around on a farm as a child and how she thought that Santa was asking her from the basement if she had been good. We talk about her magical, some less traumatic memories about growing up in Germany and the Christmases spent there and watching Elvis movies at the military base. Now, Gay recalls watching movies on TV on Saturdays when she was young. We learn how she got into singing and later became a Beatlemaniac, and her fascination developed for all things British. She has an autograph of the band The Zombies from when they were in a hotel swimming pool. And this is probably the highlight, maybe of all my nostalgia interviews. Gay regales the story surrounding the most unusual autograph she has ever received. Three, in fact, from Lauren Bacall. Gay reveals that she was a religious nerd from childhood, and we learn that she grew up as a Southern Baptist, why she left it, and how she ended up becoming a Roman Catholic. She has worked for Yorkshire Television on religious programmes and ended up lecturing at Ripon and York St John and doing a PhD at Leeds on the relationship between the Catholic Church and the film industry. Gay also talks about her involvement with film juries at major European film festivals. Gay expresses her concerns about the shift to the right in Catholicism and how it led to her leaving Roman Catholicism, as she could no longer find her spiritual centre there. She subsequently discovered Unitarian Universalism and was ordained. Towards the end of the interview, we talk about the role of nostalgia and how Gay has boxes of nostalgic stuff. We find out why she doesn't see nostalgia as something negative. And we discuss the difference between having stifling negative experiences and working through them. We discuss the relationship between nostalgia and gaslighting with respect to the Trump administration, in terms of someone telling us that reality is different from what we think it is. And we learn that Gay once wanted to marry Paul McCartney and to write the great American novel. And Gay talks about what she still hopes to be able to do in her life and why serendipity is her key word. What an absolute privilege, via Zoom from North Carolina, to catch up for this week's nostalgia interview with Gay Morris. My name is Chris Deasy. So it is such a pleasure to have Gay Morris. Now, Gay, you're all the way. Are you in North Carolina or in Georgia at the moment?
I'm in North Carolina at the very edge of the continent. We're in the Outer Banks, which is just right out in the Atlantic.
Yeah. And because I always associate you with Augusta, Georgia. And of course, actually, the last Zoom interview I did was with somebody in Athens, Georgia. So there's obviously a bit of a connection. I've interviewed a few Texas people as well. But of course, I know you from your time in the UK, which must go back, what, 20 years now?
Yes, I spent over 20 years living in the UK, and I moved back in 2002.
Yeah, and we collaborated, we were just saying before we started recording, it must have been 13, 14 years ago, on a book on theology and film, and that was a real labour of love. Oh, you've got, there we are. Well, that's the image that we're going to use in the promotion. This is an audio interview, but Gay is just a bit of a copy of the book, which is fantastic again. And I always find that my students, I'm sure they don't do it because they want to get a few extra marks, but it's very often quoted, and that's a real pleasure, because when you're working on the project, sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees. You don't always know when it's, what it's going to finally look like, particularly when there's more than one author involved. But I think it was a really successful piece of work that we collaborated on?
I think so. And I think the important thing about it was, well, for me, the reason that it came to mind as something that I wanted to do was actually moving back to the United States from the UK and realizing that there was this huge Christian culture that was being built up alongside secular culture. And so there were Christian diet books and Christian movies and Christian TV channels, and everything was being built parallel as if the real world were somehow contaminating or tainting to Christians. And so our book was about the sacred and the secular.
Yeah, and it feels really prescient because at the time we were dealing with some really good theoretical topics, and we were looking at how a theologian might apply issues around life after death or war or justice, etc. But somehow the events of the last decade or so, where you really see that there's a culture war going on, really getting to the heart, not just of America, but I think we see it particularly in the UK around Brexit as well, that these are not, you know, when I wrote the book with you, I was often looking, you know, going back to Augustine and Aquinas and sort of looking for like the key, almost like the progenitors of the debate that we were then applying to film. But it kind of feels right. That these issues are really alive and well in popular culture, in politics, all around us in the economy. And I don't know about you, but it feels that that book is more timely now than it was when we were working on it in the mid-2000s.
Oh, yeah. I think it has proved to be timeless up until now.
Yeah. And so that was a real pleasure. And of course, the book before that, which was Explorations in Theology and Film, was actually groundbreaking for me because I was doing my PhD. Of course, it turns out that we were both doing PhDs at kind of the same time.
Yes.
But that book came out about a year or so into my own PhD. And you know how some people will often say that if they come across a book that's in their area, they think, oh no, how can I possibly proceed with this? Because somebody else has sort of got there first. For me, the complete opposite, because it vindicated, it validated what I was working on, because I was trying to look at connections between theology and film when, apart from John May and Neil Hurley, there wasn't really all that much stuff, certainly not all that much stuff that was before the Martin and Oswald book from 95. So yeah. It was one of those moments when suddenly I thought, this sort of means that I can go to my supervisor or go to the panel, you know, at the Viva and say, it's not just me, I'm not doing something completely deviant or aberrant, you know, this is kind of cutting edge work, but embryonic. And it was nice then to be able to work on those. Well, indeed, explorations. That's a really good and key word in the title.
That's right. And I remember the year it was published, I went to the American Academy of Religion and Society for Biblical Literature convention conference, and it was in San Francisco, and flew over from England for that. And meeting teachers from colleges and universities who were saying, I'm using your book in my students like this and that. And it was just so exciting because it was really a validation of looking at popular culture. Whereas before, you know, scholars had been doing lots on Ingmar Bergman and Fellini, but little on, you know, the Terminator films.
Absolutely. And actually, you've got a story, haven't you, about Linda Hamilton. Is it right? Were you on a plane? And you,
yes.
you met Linda Hamilton.
Yes, she was on the plane, and I saw her and thought, oh my gosh, that's Linda Hamilton. I've got to say something. And so when we got off the plane, I said, you know, I've written a book, a chapter in a book about you, about Terminator. And she was thrilled. She was so nice. And I just thought, well, that was, you know, one of the life goals is to meet somebody who you really admire and who's been a figure in your own development. And that Terminator film for me was one of the most exciting things because, of course, she was a female hero. And I taught feminist theology and I thought it was great.
And I remember meeting Scorsese's editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, and I think I was so overwhelmed to be meeting somebody who was really at the heart of my own research and cinematic passions. And it was actually a slightly awkward experience, and it wasn't quite as thrilling as it was for you, because I think she didn't, it was at a meeting in Canterbury, actually, and she gave a talk, and she was with an audience not of people who necessarily knew Scorsese's work, but it was because of her association with Michael Powell. But it was wonderful to meet her. But one of those sort of moments when suddenly she's thinking, who is this guy coming up who says that he's been looking at my work in his PhD? So I think she sort of like physically stepped back and just thought, oh no, what sort of conversation is this going to be? And I sort of came across probably as somebody who's going to ask all these intellectual questions, but of course that wasn't my plan at all. And it was one of those sort of moments, and I thought, do you know what, maybe the idea of Selma Schumacher is better than the actuality, because you're suddenly realizing that you know more about them than they know about you. And it's on a plane, I can easily imagine what would have happened if she said, I don't want to talk to you, or what weird research, and suddenly that would undermine everything that you've been building up in the decades,
right?
Before that. But it was a really funny thing, just thinking back to that book, because in the late 90s, when you think about it, we were looking at, and you were certainly looking at it in the book with Clive, at, you know, Shawshank Redemption appeared there, and you'd have Unforgiven, lots of great sort of 80s and 90s films. But one thing I found is that for the years after that, I'd be teaching my students, and they'd all know these films, and they'd all watch them, and they would be using them Groundhog Day. You know, they'd be really sort of obvious cutting-edge examples. But as the years went on, I find now that I'd refer to some of these films, and maybe one or two of the students had heard of them, but they haven't always seen them. And the students are now teaching me. So what a change from 20-odd years ago. I'm now the teacher who is being taught by my students, because my filmography hasn't necessarily adapted as well as it should have done.
Yes, I think you're right. And, you know, there is a canon, I think, that we would agree are films that we would teach that hold up. But you think of some of them and think, students these days aren't going to be interested in that.
Yeah. And so, but the good thing, I think, about what we were working on is this idea that we were taking particular examples, but applying it to, and very aware that debates move on. We're very aware that some of the examples, I think the Iraq War was one of the things that we looked at in some detail, or certainly in your chapter on war, that, you know, may be on some levels less timely now, but in terms of application, you know, we may, the films might no longer stand the test of time, and it might be that some of the particular examples from theology that we're using haven't. But I think from a student point of view, and also in terms of keeping ourselves afresh, that's kind of a good starting point for us to move on and see what kind of subsequent explorations there are, because no book is stuck in time. The idea that it's, you know, once it's published, it's going to be always we'd like it to think that it's always going to be the book that everybody uses in their teaching. But of course, inevitably, the kind of works that come out, the kind of go-to texts, and even the type of courses that are being run, and the type of research that's taking place, is going to evolve. But certainly, I think we were both at the cutting edge, certainly 20 years ago, in terms of what we were putting out. And it really seemed, I think, to turn heads, as you said, at the AAR. People were really sort of interested in what you were working on. It felt really fresh, really different, in what was a very staid, and in many cases, very, perhaps to some degree still is, very masculine discipline.
Yes, and I think actually when we were doing our work on the book, it was kind of a period of transition. From the older ideas about how you study film and theology, and especially, you know, looking at Christ figures, for example, which was a particular thing that a lot of people did and found very interesting work to do there. But we were shifting to cultural studies, and people like you and Melanie Wright, who really, I think, reinvigorated the theological exploration of films. So it was a good time to engage with film and theology.
And are you still doing work in this kind of area, or have you branched out into other interests and passions?
Actually, I still am writing. I'm writing mainly reviews for theological journals. But I did contribute several articles for the Biblical Reception of Film, the De Gruyter Press huge encyclopedia project that they've got online. And so I've done a lot for them on the environment, and also I wrote one about the films of John Huston, so which I'm really proud of because I loved those films. And even though they're a while back, you know, it was fun writing about those.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. I remember I was asked to contribute a few, and I did one on film noir, I think one on redemption. And then I thought, I'm going to bow out, because there was a point when I thought, I'm not sure I've got anything different to say. And I was very conscious that it became almost a kind of encapsulation or a synopsis of everything I'd already done. And I think I thought I needed to just step away, even from the field a little bit. And I still work with film, certainly in my teaching, but the work on Christmas has a bit on film, but not exclusively so. And then the nostalgia material, which is obviously ongoing. It's kind of nice, I think, to have a very clear base for people to associate you with a particular area. But there's also a point when just because you've got a PhD in a certain area doesn't mean that you have to then do nothing but that forever. Otherwise, you're just kind of like dry out, really. And I think it's always good to reinvigorate yourself. And it sounds like you're doing just that.
Well, yes. And, you know, when I moved back from England, I wanted to continue in academia, but I knew that I probably would never find, certainly around Augusta, any theological college. So I started teaching for the Augusta University, which is part of the University of Georgia system. And I taught mainly public speaking, and then media and communication studies. And then they let me teach a few religion and film classes. So it was nice. But now I'm teaching online, and I'm teaching public speaking to undergraduates, and it's a lot of fun. It's come, as you say, it's different, and it's not what I did in England, but that's okay. A change is as good as a rest.
Absolutely. And how are you finding then during lockdown? You mentioned that you're teaching online. Was that something that you were doing prior to lockdown? And maybe you're ahead of the game than I was, because I was really flummoxed. Although I do these interviews and I'm used to going around with a microphone, suddenly having to teach online, I had to buy a new laptop. I had to really retrain myself, but doing it in many cases from my children's bedroom, you know, because we were all living and teaching and working in very separate environments. And I think sort of just getting the hang of that. But was that your experience?
Well, yeah, I had been ministering at a church full time for 6 years in Augusta as a Unitarian Universalist minister. And then met and married my husband, who is a Unitarian minister up here in the Outer Banks. And we decided that I would move up here rather than him move down there, because when you think of retirement in a few years, you know, Augusta really doesn't come close to being on the Outer Banks. And so I moved up here, and I wasn't going to co-minister with him, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was talking to the head of communications at the university, and he said, we're piloting this new online public speaking program, and if it goes well, then we'll be looking for somebody to teach it in the fall. And I said, well, I wouldn't have to be in Augusta to teach it, would I? And he said, no. And I said, well, let me try it. And it was a steep learning curve last fall. That was when I first started. And then in the spring, the classes that I taught were really easy, a lot of fun. And of course, halfway through, my colleagues had to switch online. But this was always an online course. And there are a lot of students who need online courses. There are parents who may have children at home. There are athletes whose schedules aren't going to allow them to be in a class on a Tuesday and a Thursday every week. And there are people who work. So it's really for greater access to higher education, and I think it really is very valuable. So when the lockdown happened and, you know, the pandemic started, I felt really sorry for my colleagues who had to scramble. But I'm doing fine with it, and I've been able to help some of them actually keep their sanity by helping them with the online stuff.
Yeah, no, I think that's really admirable, because when certainly I was an undergraduate going back in the 90s, we didn't have anything like the provision that we have now. So if there'd been a global pandemic in that period, I think they would just have had to close the program. You know, we'd all have to sort of take a year out, defer our studies. But I think it's amazing how so many people now have really engaged with the opportunity to study alone. In some cases, we have no choice, particularly people who are shielding, for example. But something I've always found is that I'd have students who were often sending in their apologies because they were meant to come to a class at 9 a.m. and they'd be commuting all the way from London down to Canterbury. Sometimes they'd send me a message at 10 to 9 just as I'm about to go over to the lecture theatre to say they're stuck on a train in Sevenoaks or somewhere. And I used to think, gosh, they're spending all this money and for an hour or two's lecture, and then that might be the only lecture they have that day. But somehow now I think the ground has shifted, and it sounds like you were actually ahead of the game. Obviously, you didn't anticipate a global pandemic, but it sounds as though in terms of pedagogy, in terms of having an inclusive education and being able to be there for audiences, for students who are not able to physically meet in a classroom on a regular basis, it seems perfect. And so long as you're happy doing that from your home, then in that regard it's kind of a match made in heaven.
Yeah, and not only that, but I'm still able to do pulpit supply and preach at other places. I was supposed to be at the end of May in Charleston, South Carolina, to preach at the Unitarian Church there, and of course couldn't go, so they rescheduled me to Labor Day weekend. But of course I'm going to be doing that from here. So, and that's fine, because that's what everybody's doing, is still preaching, because of course one of the places you mustn't go at the moment is church, and even worse, to sing in church, which is really heartbreaking to a lot of people. But you know, managing to have a service online is it's the same kind of steep learning curve that my colleagues in the university had, my ministry colleagues are having, you know, having to figure out how to provide either on Zoom or Facebook or YouTube for their congregants. And it's been a real challenge, but I think a lot of people are doing it very well.
And I was just thinking as well that, you know, jokingly I'll say to people sometimes, gosh, I'm not going to be nostalgic for 2020. But then afterwards I thought, well, maybe I will look upon this with, you know, more perhaps optimism than it seems possible at the moment, because it's that other whole conceit, which of course our book, well, certainly the book you worked on with Clive Marsh typifies, which is overcoming adversity, the sort of the myth of the American, you know, the American monomyth, the redeemer narrative, the idea that there's some great adversity, but you sort of come in and you seize that, you own it, you really see whether it's possible to do things outside of the box. And I think that this year, a lot of people, no doubt some people will, when we finally emerge from lockdown, will be very depressed, and some people will find it really destabilizing. I think for a lot of people, they look back and say, well, it just shows that what you can do when your life structure, going into work every day, or even going out of an evening, or just the kind of things that you do with friends, you can still do those things. You just might not be able to do it in geographical proximity. So 2020, I don't know what the history books will say about it, because we all thought in the UK that Brexit was going to completely, you know, change civilization. It all seems a bit of a damp squib, but somehow the pandemic has completely caught us unawares. It just goes to show, you never know what's around the corner.
That's right, you never do.
But in terms of going back, Gay, because obviously we're looking at the theme of nostalgia, in terms of, you know, background and earliest memories, what are the things that you remember from childhood? Because I'm guessing that you grew up in Georgia, would that be right?
Well, I was born in Augusta, Georgia, which, by the way, is the home of James Brown, and also the place where the Masters Golf Tournament is played. I will also mention that North Augusta, which is just across the river in South Carolina, is where Brenda Lee was born, and also Sharon Jones, who some people call the female James Brown. So I come from a place that has a lot of good music.
I feel good music.
But I didn't stay in Augusta long. My dad was in the military, and so we moved around. We lived in Germany when I was in first, second grade. Before that, we'd been in Indiana, and then we went to Pennsylvania, and then we came back to Augusta when I was about 9. So, you know, my earliest memories are really from the time we were in Indiana. We lived on a farm with the family who owned the farm. And I had kind of the run of the place. And I remember going into the basement where the washing machine was, and fooling around down there. And it was Christmas time, and I was pretending that I was talking to Santa. And suddenly this booming Santa voice said, And so have you been good? And what do you want for Christmas? And I was freaking out down in the basement. What I didn't know was that the vent, the heating vent, came up from the kitchen, and they could hear me up there. And so the farmer started talking to me as if he were Santa. And it didn't traumatize me for the rest of my life, but it was a really scary thing. So obviously those kind of memories, early memories, are what stick with you when they're that shocking.
And isn't it interesting when, and I guess that's what Gremlins is all about, but that sort of notion of something, Christmas is often seen to be very innocent and pure and wonderful and beatific. And then, of course, it's the trauma of Christmas, all the dysfunction, all the mismatch between how we want it to be or how it should be and how it actually is, you know, makes it even more, you know, it makes it far more multi-layered and a sort of a ritual that we can't avoid. But somehow each year we go into it, even though we know that, you know, every Christmas up to now has been imperfect, but we still sort of all have this hope that somehow we're gonna ride it out, and it's gonna be, it's, you know, one day we're gonna have that perfect Christmas. We never have it, but we keep trying each year.
Yeah. No, the trauma that I kind of experienced there, whenever I saw the movie The City of Lost Children, at the very beginning when the little boy is in his crib and all these Santas come out of the chimney, you know, a lot of people have traumatic memories of Christmas, I guess. But then whenever I was little, we moved to Germany, and Christmas in Germany is just magical. So anything that was frightening about Santa talking to me in the basement in Indiana just kind of vanished. And Germany was just a magical place. And I used to spend a lot of time, my parents for Christmas, I guess, one year or my birthday, got me a Patty Play Pal. And you probably never heard of Patty Play Pal, but she was life-size, child size, with long blonde hair and movable joints. And so I used to play with her as if she was my friend. It's not that I didn't have friends, but I didn't have any nearby. And so I would play with my Patty Play Pal the whole time. But, you know, just remembering Germany and the food and the plum cake, and, you know, it was a wonderful place to live. And I did learn German, and then I've lost it. I don't speak it anymore.
How did you feel about going back to the States afterwards? Because it's like a holiday where, and I've got the fondest memories of holidays we had when we were young, but I'm quite sure that if we were to live all the time in that holiday environment, it wouldn't be so wonderful, because the whole point is that holiday is time out. If you do a Shirley Valentine and you make the holiday, you know, your new reality, then everything else has to be sort of reframed. But so you spent time in Germany. Was that a real culture shock? Did it sort of pave the way for the many years that you spent working in the UK?
I don't think it has had any connection with that. But being an army brat, you had to adjust. And so it was expected that, you know, we would spend a few years here and a few years there. When I went to Pennsylvania after that, it was a small town called Carlisle. And the thing about that is that it introduced me to TV. I used to watch on Saturday mornings movies. I watched all the Shirley Temple movies and all of the Busby Berkeley dance things. And so I was inspired, and the kids in the neighborhood and I would go out and we would put on shows for the parents. So it was a place where we did a lot of fun stuff because of, I think, what we learned from the TV.
So in later years, when you were doing work in media, do you kind of feel that you were recapturing a lot of that essence? Because, you know, something as seminal as that, something as momentous as, you know, what you can remember as a five-year-old or a 10-year-old, whatever, I guess I found it in my own research. I'm very aware that I'm channeling the interests and the passions I had, often radio-based. For me, film came much later. But it's very interesting, isn't it, how sometimes we can't shake that off, and we need to process that to assimilate it. Research is a perfect way of trying to work out that trajectory that we're on.
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved media, and it could be that was where it got started. When I was in Germany, we used to go to the children's movies at the military base, and so I got to see all the Elvis movies back then. But you know, when my dad got out of the military and we moved back to Augusta, Georgia, I got into singing instead, and I'd never really sung before. Actually, I had sung before on German national radio. Our class, which was an American school, had put on a program, and I had played my ukulele and sung with another girl, but that was it. And so when we went to Georgia, my grandparents on my mother's side used to go to what we called sing-ins. And these were like Southern Baptist people who would get together for a whole day, take a picnic lunch, and just sing all day, sing hymns and gospel music. And it was amazing. I used to love that. And then on my dad's side, I had two older cousins, and we formed a gospel trio at one point, and I was the alto. And I was about 10 or 11. And we used to go around and sing at different evangelical or Pentecostal churches, which was a lot of fun. So those were that. So music became a big thing for me. And of course, when I just had moved back to Augusta, that's when the Beatles started, and I became just a Beatle maniac. Mm-hmm. And then from that grew my fascination with anything British. And when I was, I guess I was old enough to drive, because my mother called me. She was the manager of a hotel, and she called me one day and said, "Get down here. The zombies are in the swimming pool." And they had come, the zombies group had come for a concert with the Searchers in Augusta. And so I drove myself down to where she, you know, to her hotel, and there they were in the swimming pool. And well, actually, they were standing out putting their suntan lotion on, and I went up with my autograph book, and I said, can I have your autograph, please? I must have been 16. And one of them said, "Here, hold my suntan lotion." And so I held his suntan lotion while he wrote in my book, and I said, "I'll never wash this hand again. It has the zombie suntan lotion on it." So I was crazy about anything to do with British music by then, and then British culture.
And I'm guessing that although you presumably have washed your hands since then, you still have the autograph. I hope you still have the autograph.
I have the autograph book, yes. I used to I had the autograph book from the time I was in Germany. So I had all of my teachers and my friends sign it whenever I left. And then, you know, as I got older, my grandfather used to go to wrestling, you know how they have the wrestling matches on TV now? Well, they used to have them live down here every Monday night at an auditorium in Augusta. And so my cousin and I would go with my grandfather, and I'd get the wrestlers to autograph my book as well. Mm-hmm. So I've found it. I haven't lost it. I've still got it with all the zombie autographs in it too.
No, and I always find that, yeah, the days when at school we'd all be like doing two things. We'd be getting the autographs of our classmates, because we may not see them again as we make our way, for example, into secondary school. But then you'd go to a concert, or some celebrity would come. Remember Max Boyce, there we are, came to our school once, or you know, the Radio 1 Roadshow, and we'd go and see the DJs going around the seaside towns. And then they'd have their signatures in the book. So the strange juxtaposition of 10-year-olds and then the sort of like big, you know, concert singers or DJs who were sort of like, you know, known nationally, if not internationally. So yeah, and I don't know if people still do use autograph books in the same way. I suppose people will often sign clothing, or they'll sign particular, I don't know, artifacts, I suppose, that are associated with them. But autograph books, I have got one somewhere, but I think it's a long time since anybody graced it with a signature.
Well, I think the most unusual autograph I got, and unfortunately it has faded so that it's not there anymore, but you may remember that every year in Portugal, I don't know whether it still happens, but there's the film festival, the Troia Film Festival, and it's an hour south of Lisbon, and it was on a peninsula, a resort peninsula, and the very first year that I went as a member of the Catholic jury for that film festival, oh gosh, and her name has just gone right, Lauren Bacall was the special guest. Every year they had a special guest, either a director or a star, and she was there. And so I was walking with my program for the film festival to the lunch hall, and she was walking across. And so I went up to her and I said, could I have your autograph, please? And she said, sure. And I said, here, could you just sign my my program? And then I also had my meal ticket for lunch. And I said, could you sign my meal ticket? And she said, and I'll never forget, you know, what kind of a place is this that has a meal ticket? And I thought, wow. But of course, she signed it and the ink has gone now. I've still got what she signed, but I don't have the signature.
I have to say that was a very good Lauren Bacall impression. I almost thought you were going to say, you know how to whistle, don't you? You just put your lips.
Yeah.
No, she was magnificent and very, I mean, of course, she was still making films well into her 80s. But, yes. You know, she really had that presence. And, of course, I remember watching the Oscars when everyone thought she was going to win for The Mirror Has Two Faces and she lost to Juliette Binoche. But it was, you know, a real privilege watching her because, of course, she was making all those films with Humphrey Bogart in the 40s. And yet her passion, you know, when she was working with, who was the director, the European filmmaker, very controversial, name will come to me in a minute, but working with a lot of sort of Scandinavian, like Dogville, for example. And she was really...
Lars von Trier.
Yeah, Lars von Trier. And, you know, in that sense, she was doing really, you know, you'd expect her maybe to be making, you know, the typical Hollywood products. But she was, you know, really being very adventurous, I think, in later years. And I think her career trajectory has been phenomenal. But, mm-hmm. Wow. So your autograph, who else have you got in your autograph book? You've got the zombies, you've got Lauren Bacall. Who else?
Yeah, and, you know, I one year when I was there in Portugal, Zukoski was there, and I didn't get his autograph. But there, you know, I kind of stopped doing that. It's kind of embarrassing for a grown person to go up and do that, I think. So.
But then again, I suppose you've probably had book signings yourself, or I'm guessing that you've had students at least who come up to you and said, "Can you sign the book?" Which they have maybe bought because you're teaching that particular module.
Yeah, that was weird. Yeah, I found that very strange to have that happen, but you know, fun in a way.
And I find the funniest bit is when you're teaching in an area where you've published, and then when students give their class presentations, they never quite know how to deal with you because they're quoting you because your name is on the reading list together with, you know, many other authors. But because they know you as the teacher and they don't know whether to refer to you by your surname, your first name, or a combination of the two, and they sort of look up and mouth sometimes, is that okay? Because then they don't know how to address you. And it's one of those moments when I feel sometimes I much prefer it when I'm teaching in an area where I don't have any particular stake in the area, because you kind of feel that you're, on the one hand, infusing students and inspiring students, but it must be a bit weird for them if you're also part of the narrative, because you're both the teacher and also the person who's reading material you're setting for them. So it kind of feels that there's potentially a few line crossings going on there.
Yeah, it's interesting. And what's even more interesting is when they misquote you.
Yeah, well, and of course, in our case, because we worked on that book together, that sometimes they would sometimes quote you for something that I'd written, or vice versa, or all that. And in the end, I thought, well, how would they know? I just leave that one. I park that one. I thought, I'm not going to, otherwise it looks a little bit too, you know, he protested a little bit too much.
I know. But you know what? Actually, I'm just remembering that the first time we met, you were doing your postgraduate work, I think?
You were at the conference. Was it Edinburgh?
It was at a conference. Okay. Well, but there was a time when you came up and introduced yourself. I thought it was Oxford or Cambridge or someplace like that. And we were at a session during this conference, and the person who was hosting that session started introducing a colleague of ours, but talking about me and saying, she's done this and that, and she's written this and that, and her work is really great. But it wasn't me that was being introduced; it was another colleague. And the colleague finally stopped him and said, "Yeah, she's wonderful, but that's not who I am." I don't know if you remember that, but it was really embarrassing.
I can remember that now. If I recall, you gave a paper on your work on juries, on film juries and Catholic film juries. And I have this recollection now of something really embarrassing. And it happens, of course, when sometimes you're introduced at a conference, but the person doesn't really know you, but they've got something off your like course materials or your web page or that, and they start reading out all the books that you've published or all the articles, and they sort of go through all this, and you're thinking, oh, this is really, and you're just like squirming because you kind of feel like I mean, I suppose on the other hand, if people go to my Facebook page and they get a completely different understanding of who I am. But it's very funny how we are defined sometimes in a very niche way. And then somebody introduces you and you kind of feel, I wish I'd done that myself. You know, I'd rather introduce myself. I've often said that at conferences. I'd much rather do that rather than somebody who doesn't really know you, who potentially gets it a bit wrong. And there's that awkward moment where you don't want to interrupt them, but at the same time, you kind of feel that you want to do yourself justice.
Yes, I know. That's right.
But I was just thinking in terms of how you entered academia, because I obviously know you were doing your PhD. You were based in York for many years. But how did you end up pursuing... well, theology or theology. I mean, how would you define yourself? It's the worst question. I mean, there's nothing worse than sometimes somebody saying, you know, in one word or in one sort of phrase, you know, how would you define who you are? And often that changes, of course, over time. But how did you end up, what was the path that you took that led to you, for example, working at York St. John?
Well, I would say that I was always a religion nerd. From the time of being a small child and loving the ritual of communion and then the gospel music. When I was 14 or 15, I was a Southern Baptist. I grew up a Southern Baptist, and the church elders fired the minister who was doing great work with the youth group. And I was so upset about it, I decided I'm just through with Southern Baptist religion. I'm going to look around. And I started reading all the other different kinds of religious texts. And then I had a friend who invited me to Mass. And I thought, boom, as soon as I walked in and smelled the incense, that's it for me. And I became a Catholic. I marched into the priest's office when I was 16 and said, I'd like to become a Catholic, please. And so I got through the catechism and got my first communion and confirmed. And then I decided I wanted to be a nun because I went to Sunday school, and the nun who was teaching was an Irish nun, Sister Odile, and she was amazing. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I actually want to go and teach children in the inner city in Savannah. There were Franciscan nuns there. And so she took me down for a weekend to spend with the Franciscan nuns, and it was amazing. What sealed the deal for me, I thought, was that they actually go swimming at the beach and they wear swimsuits. And I thought, hey, if you can do that as a nun, you can do anything, right? So, but then I met my first husband, and we decided we didn't really have vocations because he was actually thinking of becoming a priest, but we got married instead. So, but I was also teaching catechism, Sunday school classes from the time of being 18, 19. And I just, the more I taught, the more questions I had. And so then when we moved to England in 1983, I became the religious education chair in the parish there, and started looking for more resources, and found the RE Center in Leeds, which was run by another wonderful nun, and found out that there was a Catholic college, and I thought, well, I'll actually do a degree in teaching or art or something. And the only thing they had was theology and public media. And I had had a 2-year degree from when I lived in Texas in radio, TV, film. And so I decided, well, maybe there's a connection there. And so my love of religion drove me into that. But of course, when I was growing up, the word theologian was never mentioned. I didn't know what a theologian was. I had no idea that there was such a person. So it was just a great revelation to me going into higher education. And by then, of course, I had children. And so we were all studying together. They would come home and study and I would study. And it was wonderful. So when I got my degree in theology and public media, I was asked if I'd like to teach at Trinity and All Saints College. That's where I got my degree. In the meantime, I spent a year back in the States working for public access television, producing an interfaith discussion program. And so I came back in 1989 and started working for Yorkshire Television on their program 7 days and also 7 days and 5 minutes. It's interesting, two programs with times, but they were religious programs. And then I decided I'd like to do my Master of Theology degree because I was also teaching by then part-time at Trinity and All Saints and also at Ripon and York St. John. In Christian communication. So it all kind of went together, and then I went up to Edinburgh and did my Master of Theology up there, then followed that up with starting to teach full-time. I got a faculty tenure-track position at Ripon and York St. John, and then started doing my PhD at University of Leeds on the relationship between the Catholic Church and the film industry. So that's how, really. And then in between all of that, the Catholic Communication Center in London, I met those people down there, and they started putting me in for the juries, the Catholic juries that were at major European film festivals. And so I got to go to some wonderful film festivals besides Portugal. I was at Cannes, and also Locarno. So it was great. I really enjoyed my time there. So you talk about nostalgia, you know, coming back to the States. It was such a culture shock. And I do still keep in touch with a lot of my friends, especially from Ripon and York St. John, which is now York St. John University. And I'm hoping that my second husband, I remarried last year, David, and I can go next year maybe for a visit. I'd love to show him the sights and let him meet some of my friends. And, you know, it's such an important part of my life. I think he needs to experience it too.
Absolutely. And I obviously it'd be lovely to meet you in person as well. But I was just thinking, Berlin comes to mind because you wrote on this, and it's one of the texts I use with my students about the Berlin Film Festival in 1994 when Priest was shown. Were you at that? Were you on the jury that year?
I was not at Berlin, but that was a huge, I think, a watershed for the Catholic Church to be aware that. There were several times when Catholic juries confounded traditional Catholic teaching. And that was one of the times when popular culture and cultural norms came up against traditional Catholicism. There, you know, from the time I was beginning to teach up until I came back here, there was such a shift, a reactionary shift to the right in Catholicism. I was so sad to see the world closing in on the Catholic Church when they were refusing to confront and be open to the moving of the Spirit as I see it, you know, the increasing respect for humanity in all our forms. And so when I got back here, I stopped going to Mass. I couldn't concentrate, couldn't find my spiritual center there. And I always say, I think the church left me. I think it left a lot of people. And so that's when I discovered Unitarian Universalism and found that it was my spiritual home, and then decided I wanted to be ordained. I'd always, you know, when I was in England, I used to go to the meetings of the Catholics for women's ordinations, and always thought that I might be called. So when I came here and I became a Unitarian Universalist, you know, Universalists were ordaining women in the 1860s. So, you know, I found that that was a very welcoming place for me and for my theology.
No, and I think that you find the same in politics, whereas maybe 30, 40 years ago, it was quite normal for people to vote for the same party all their lives to have that sort of sense of residual identity. You'd vote. I remember being at university and people would, you know, just follow their parents in terms of how they voted. That has changed so much in the last decade or two, certainly in the UK. And what you said there about the Catholic Church is really insightful, because obviously that is very much your research. And I remember in that article where you look at what happened with Priest at the Berlin Film Festival, you've got the different sort of, you know, what I think it was Archbishop, was it O'Connor, the New York Archbishop, who was scathing about the film. And then you also had the members of the jury who could see, you know, don't just look at the dissimilarities, look at issues around faith and companionship and family and inclusivity, and, you know, in other words, don't just look at where the film departs from Catholicism, but also it can also show a more progressive way forward. And I thought that that was a bit of a turning point. It's a bit sad in that sense that you feel that the direction of travel has not been progressive. But on a lighter note, I remember having a conversation with you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it's about the Big Lebowski. And I wasn't aware that you weren't then, and this was probably around the period when you left Catholicism, or it had left you, in relation to, you said, I think, that every year there was a service. Am I right? And I think you maybe even have preached one year when everybody would go in their bathrobes and the congregation would dress in the style of the Dude Lebowski. Was that a weird dream that I once had, or did that actually happen?
No.
Put the record straight.
No. When I started my ministry in the congregation in Augusta, I was always teaching. I was always doing adult education courses on film, and I did one on food and film and one on rites of passage and film. And so then I decided, well, we should actually do a Big Lebowski weekend. And I had a lot of young people who were really excited about this, but some older people too. And so on that Friday night, we had a whole weekend. Friday night, we showed the film. My son-in-law made a cake. And if you know the film, he made a toe cake with a green toe polish, nail polish. And then we had white Russians. You know, and then we watched the film, and then the next day we all went to the bowling alley, and people came in their bathrobes, and one girl came with a Viking horn helmet, and we bowled. I don't know what the people in the bowling alley thought of us, but anyway, we had a great time. And then the next day was Sunday, and I preached on dudeology and the idea that the dude abides. So it was a lot of fun. What I hadn't remembered showing the film on that Friday night was how many F words were. It was like 170 times that he used the F word. And that kind of thing from years of being in juries and teaching film just kind of goes over me. I don't notice it. But there were a few people who were a bit surprised. But being a very liberal congregation, there was no problem with it. But we had a great time with Big Lebowski, and there's a lot of theology in there, a lot of dudeology.
So I always find it an interesting sort of relationship between film and theology, theology and film, in terms of, Clive Marsh has said this about how a lot of students these days might not know a lot about redemption, but they've seen The Shawshank Redemption, which, funny enough, actually is returning to the cinemas near where I live next week, because obviously in lockdown not many new films are out at the moment. So I can't wait. I saw it first time around before it was a big hit, and I sort of saw it when it was this sort of sleeper movie, and, you know, had good word of mouth, but it wasn't the big sort of huge, almost like cultural event that it became. But it's funny how then The Shawshank Redemption, people will often say, well, I'm interested in some of the questions that it explores. And then that is what takes them into the study of religion and theology, rather than somebody who, like me, did a degree in theology and then found that I had this passion for film. And one day I thought, well, I have to try and bring these together, because otherwise it was, you know, maybe I've always had a problem with binaries, but it felt in my case, particularly around the time I was doing my MA, when I'd be watching a film like The Witches of Eastwick of an evening, but writing on hell for an essay in the day, and thinking sometimes, well, there's a crossover here. But in those days, the idea that you'd write about film in an academic context seemed completely incongruous. But I think we changed that, and I think we made the study of popular culture completely okay. And look at what happens on the syllabus of so many university departments in theology, religious studies, where we teach film. That wasn't happening before the 90s.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. So good on us.
Good on us. There we are. And I was just thinking, in terms of, as we start to wrap up, some more philosophically based questions, Gay. I mean, in a way, you've answered some of these already, but would you say that your memories are predominantly positive as you look back over your life and career?
Yeah, I do. You know, everybody has some bad times in their lives, but especially the UK. I mean, we moved here. My husband already had an apartment here, and I had a house in Augusta. And so when I moved up here, we were putting together two households in one household. And all of this, I mean, this is my study, and it is packed. I have boxes that I still haven't unpacked. I have all kinds of stuff from my academic days. You know, I even have the draft copy of Explorations in Theology and Film. I haven't been able to throw that away. So yeah, a lot of stuff is so positive for me. And the other day, I just happened to look in my bedroom, and you can't, obviously, if this is audio, you can't see it, but I found it and I thought, I've got to talk about it. It's an old wooden box and it's decoupage, and you can see it there. It's just this decoupage box that my mother gave me. But when you open up the top, it says, Paul McCartney and Gay Williams, because I wrote that because I was sure that I was going to marry Paul McCartney when I was a child. So, but I've had this box all this time, and inside of it is all kinds of badges. There's my badge from when I visited Port Merion in Wales. It's number one.
Oh, is that where the prisoner was?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've got all kinds of stuff. I've got Anderson, for president in 1980, I worked for his campaign, which was a big mistake because I think he probably helped put Ronald Reagan into office because he was a third party. And here in the States, you just can't do third parties. You can in Europe, but here it just has terrible consequences. So anyway, I had fun looking through that. So yeah, I mean, my husband and I are very nostalgic about the start of our relationship, how we found each other when we didn't, at a time when we didn't think that was going to happen again. And so we, in particular, read the poems of David White because we first decided to go further in our relationship when we were at a David White poetry workshop in Charleston. So yes, I have a lot of positive memories. I enjoyed doing that. I enjoy memories.
Because I think nostalgia is as much about the future and the present as it is about the past, because it's what you do with all of that. And I mean, obviously sometimes, I mean, there's memories of the past that sometimes we can be indifferent to, or we might think, oh yeah, I vaguely remember something happened. But with nostalgia, there's something very wistful. There's something going on there where we kind of want to recapture something that we feel that we've lost. And then the question is, do we sort of just be very wistful and melancholic, or do we try and do something about that? And in some cases, that can be about re-meeting people who you've fallen out of touch with. Facebook, of course, is a perfect way. It's a great sort of repository for nostalgia because you have the chance to pick up on some of those exchanges and those conversations that you had 20, 30 or more years ago. So it sounds like you have your own nostalgia box by the sound of it.
at least one, if not more. But yeah, I mean, I think social media has been great in fostering nostalgia looking forward, because I am in touch, for example, with two of my good friends from high school still on Facebook. We're in touch all the time, and one of them I see whenever I go to Augusta. But it makes you nostalgic for the past, but also, you know, thinking of going forward with that relationship, which probably wasn't a possibility for, you know, my parents' generation.
Yeah, and I think that Facebook has helped. Were you in touch with those two friends before Facebook? Have you been, you've always maintained contact? It wasn't that you lost contact and then came back into contact through social media?
Well, no, I mean, actually, one of them, of course, moved out to California and Hawaii, and so I hadn't seen him in years. And so Facebook suddenly brought him back into my life. So that was great.
What about the opposite of that, though, in terms of negative experiences? Can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
You know, I don't see nostalgia as something negative. I think that there are times when you relive those negative experiences, but I don't think that's nostalgia. I kind of feel like that's when you get stuck, when you are down or feeling hopeless. I really try not to, you know, I think there's a difference between trying to stifle negative experiences and memories and working through them so that you can deal with them. Sometimes we're more successful with some memories than others.
I agree with you. I think sometimes it can be a real spur, because feeling a little bit wistful or melancholic about something, it can actually be a good thing, because it puts you in mind of how, you know, you can either then just be complacent or not do anything about it, or you can try and seize the day. It's sort of, for me, nostalgia is a great springboard for not leaving things until they're too late. So although I was working a few years ago on eschatology and life after death, yeah, it kind of feels that nostalgia is just the other side of that same coin.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Tell me what you mean by that a little bit more.
It's almost like recapturing something pre-lapsarian. I suppose it's like the Garden of Eden. It's the sort of idea of the fall, going back to something, wanting to get something back that we feel, whether we've actually lost it or just have the perception of losing it. That sense that Christmas can be a perfect catalyst for that. The sense that, you know, often how many people will say, oh, it was much better when I was younger, or, you know, there's this association with growing up sometimes. And it was never really like that. I mean, I keep a diary. And, you know, quite often, and maybe even just, you know, about a film, that you think that you really liked it at the time, but you look back in the diary and actually it's not all that extraordinary. You've actually imbued it with something extraordinary due to the different layers of meaning since, or, you know, you through conversations, due to maybe what just seems particularly PC at a particular time, or, you know, suddenly you think, oh, I was really into that when I was younger. And maybe it's more the present day you trying to sort of go back over the past and, you know, in the light of what's going on now. And I think all these different layers tend to be quite normal. But for me, nostalgia can be very much about how we plan for the future, because we can often say that the way we did things 20, 30 years ago isn't the way that we want to continue to do things. And in some cases you might say, I want to leave that behind. But there's often that sense of essence, and there's a going back and going forward, that whole question of what do we really stand for? Who do we think we are? Is there some sort of like residual us that, you know, how many times, I'm sure it's happened to you, Gay, when somebody will say, when you haven't seen them in 20 odd years, they'll say, you're just the same. And obviously in some ways you cannot be just the same. But what they really mean is that when you start talking, that your personality is one that they recognize. And it's something in some cases quite reassuring that they know that you are the person that they've invested in all these hopes and memories and anticipations. And in a sense, there's something very comforting about that. So for me, the going back and the going forward just seem to be really on the same kind of trajectory.
Mm-hmm. I think in both of our countries these days, people's nostalgia for the past is even more poignant and very challenging at times like holidays. I remember after Trump was elected here, how polarized this country has become because of him and his politics. People were saying, how am I going to have Thanksgiving dinner like we always did and be able to sit at the same table with some of our relatives who are Trump supporters, you know, not who only voted for him, but who really are pushing the things that he pushes. And it's awful because, you know, it really is destroying nostalgic memories of the past when you're with people who it's so difficult to be with now. So for, you know, for Thanksgiving, for Christmas, it has really changed the dynamic, I think, of the memories that we had of really nice family holidays. And now people just have to get through those dinners and leave as soon as possible. It's terrible.
I think that's right, because when you sort of use, well, his famous slogan, "Make America Great Again," of course, then for some people it's a case of, well, that's a very, you know, why not? It's always been great. Or other people will say, no, it's not great because of the other party. I mean, Trump himself, of course, has supported Democrat candidates in the past. So, you know, it's all very interesting and expedient sometimes as to why people ally themselves to particular causes. But of course, the danger is that it brings in polarization, that you're making something great again, which means changing what came before it. And it means writing out of history, whitewashing history in some respects. And I think that that's very difficult for those people who really want to hang on, maybe to a flawed past, but maybe a more realistic past, rather than the idea that somehow you're going to make everything or mold it in your image and your image alone.
Well, I think what makes a connection with your idea of nostalgia is the idea of gaslighting. More and more people are talking about gaslighting here. You know, the idea that somebody is trying to tell you that reality is different than what you think it is, and that actually you're mistaken. You're not seeing reality as it is, and that's really upsetting a lot of people, because it's questioning, well, I think, your sanity in some ways, but also your reading of what reality is. And so he and a lot of the people that work for him are very good at doing that, of trying to make you think that reality is actually quite different.
I hadn't thought of it in that way, and I think it's interesting, because gaslighting is a term that I only came across, I mean, obviously I know the film from the 40s, but about 2 years ago, when something that happened in my own life, where I was almost feeling this sense that, you know, somebody was giving me a narrative that I didn't recognize, but trying to rewrite something that had happened. And because I'm somebody who always keeps books, letters, diaries, recordings, or, you know, obviously I do these interviews, there's a sense in which I suppose I can go back and say, no, this is what I actually said or meant, or I've got the evidence for it. But otherwise you go mad. And for somebody who doesn't have that apparatus, for somebody who perhaps doesn't have a written record or a spoken record of something that happened, that's a really interesting point, because gaslighting is really been a theme that I always feel, if I was to write up my own life story, it would have to have that in it in a big way, because of the way sometimes that we all... It's perfectly okay sometimes for somebody, and it's not okay when it's someone like Donald Trump, because of the number of people he's bringing with him. But it's okay sometimes for us to try and reinvent our own past or start afresh. We all do those things sometimes, you know, start a new life, new broom and all the rest of it. But of course, when you then sometimes create a narrative that alienates or ostracizes or whitewashes what came before it, then there are some people who will feel, as you say, that they're going insane. They don't recognize that narrative. And that can happen in personal relationships, but right. It can certainly happen, and I hadn't thought of it in that way, in a political sense. Somebody can be gaslighting a country.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Of course, and the other problem with nostalgia is when you get locked into the sense of who you were and you aren't open to change. So, you know, I think I am a kind of forward-looking person, even though I love looking back, because I have a sense of hope. And I think if you didn't have hope, you just wouldn't get up in the morning. So nostalgia can be a nice thing to have, but if you're locked in, it can be a real trap.
And my very last question, that actually was going to be my last question, about whether you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person, but you've answered that. But I was just going to ask Gay to finish off whether you feel that you've fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young. I mean, would your 5 or your 15-year-old self be really surprised to see you doing what you're doing now?
Oh, I think I would be really surprised from the time I was a teenager. I had a real interest in high school in English literature, and I thought that maybe, this was before I thought I would become a nun, that I could write the great American novel. And of course, I've published 3 books and written a lot of chapters and articles, and that's great. I've enjoyed writing. But I think I still might have some work in me on growing up in the South and sort of the really funny stories from my childhood. So, you know, maybe that's a link with being back, you know, in the early part of my life. But I never planned anything. You know, I just, serendipity is just, is my keyword. So everything happens and flows, and here I am. So, you know, I didn't really have a lot of hopes or dreams or goals, and I'm thrilled with where I am now.
Well, that is the most perfect way to end the interview. So rather than finish on gaslighting, we finish on serendipity. So on that serendipitous note, Gay, thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you.